Living a sustainable, healthy life isn't possible for everyone. In this episode of the Care What You Wear and So Much More podcast, I speak with Isaias Hernandez, an environmental educator and founder of the educational site Queer Brown Vegan. Isaias reminds us that climate change is the direct result of human supremacy and the total disregard we have for how our behaviors impact not only the planet, but the lives of others. Our discussion reminded me that a healthy, sustainable lifestyle should be a right and not a privilege, and just saying you support change is no longer enough. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I learned a lot, and I'm pretty sure you will too. Isaias, welcome to the Care What You Wear podcast.
Thank you so much again for having me.
What is your backstory and who or what inspired you to become an active environmentalist?
I grew up in Los Angeles, California, also known as Tongvaland. My parents had immigrated from Mexico to the U.S. in the 1980s to seek this rhetoric of the American dream. And so my whole life, I grew up actually low income, living off food stamps, Section 8 affordable housing in Los Angeles, and living nearby a lot of toxic facilities and taking the public metro. And so I would say that my experiences with environmentalism at a young age were very confusing because I was really doing a lot of these actions that were based off survival, such as, you know, recycling cans from the trash cans in your neighborhood at a young age. And when I was in middle school, I would, you know, help my dad on the weekends clean up rich people's homes in LA and, you know, do gardening. And so I think for me, like, it was just wondering to see the examples of how environmental equity and economic differences vary by zip code. And so that kind of curiosity led me to start asking questions. And so I think part of my frustration of not knowing, like, how to explain things and rather be told by the system of, like, your parents didn't work hard enough, that's why you're poor, or this is how it is, you deserve to live there. And so I started to ask, like, why do people live in a poisoned world? And so I think when I got older and I learned about global warming, started learning about climate change in middle school and high school, that kind of got me passionate about it. And eventually that really led me to get an environmental science degree at UC Berkeley because I was so passionate about finding solutions and answers. And I felt like a lot of that pain and confusion in my younger stages of life were really in this idea of, like, how do you really collect these fragments and put them together?
That's an amazing story. Your backstory is inspiring, and you definitely think of how to be inclusive in the fight against climate change.
Yeah, and I think too, it's the fact of, like, who is able to really freely explore their passion and interest, because I think one of the largest disconnects I had even in academia and college was the fact of, like, a lot of my friends that were white and had these different moments with environmentalism where, you know, their passion was like, oh, my parents always took me to these green lands, or we'd always go to our private house in the summer. Yeah. We had all these, like, different amenities. And so I often really doubted myself to be like, I don't know, like, how to put the words of what I experienced to describe how I became passionate about environmentalism, because it was out of anger and, like, being tired and exposed to toxic chemicals. And so I felt like, what is the right place to have a narrative and to really bridge the gap between the two? Because I often felt like there was division. And it's not to say, like, we should hate those who have different lifestyles, because we all have different experiences. That's what makes us unique. But how do we really value both of them to ensure that, why are so many low-income students have so much self-shame in sharing about their experiences with the environment?
We do have to remember is that, you know, everyone has a different upbringing. Everyone has a different history. We all need to just kind of think of ways and discussions to make sure that we include everybody in the mission, you know, and it's so easy to just kind of, I don't know, look at your own situation and think everyone has the same situation.
Exactly.
It takes a lot of bravery to do what you're doing as well, to show that there's a whole different side of this discussion.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
So
You describe yourself as an environmental activist who loves un- and relearning environmental injustice and veganism and zero waste. What kind of woke you up and made you realize that everything we read online isn't always necessarily true, or there isn't just one easy fix?
Yeah, I think it started off in once I started in college, because at the same time, I believe that a lot of us, and specifically my story, I would say that like my parents like indoctrinated me to believe like work hard and you'll be awarded the American dream, quote unquote. But I think that in college, I became very radicalized to start interrogating why these systems are prevalent, why like a lot of low income first generation college students have such a hard time doing well in academics. And so when I was learning a lot of these things and concepts about the environment and climate science, it was very rooted in this binary framework of like, this is the only correct way to say it. And so I think that in unlearning part of that environmental education was to unpack a lot of this experience that was often ignored in Western science, which is indigenous lived experiences and worldviews, cultural based experiences, and our own lived experiences. And I believe that science in Western thoughts is often rooted in this idea of like, you know, numbers and data are the only way to show validity. And so I said, we're not numbers and data. At the end of the day, we have cultural stories, we have food, the way that we dress, our clothes. So there's just so much way of how we can learn about environmental education. And so when we're unlearning, it's not a beautiful process. It's really an ugly process, because you are interrogating yourself and the biased views that you uphold, whether it's racism. A lot of us, like even myself, have still a long life work to do to achieve that and fight for that. But I think that a lot of people get stuck in this idea of like unlearning, of like, this is a beautiful process. And when you relearn, you're building upon that new foundation, meaning that you're taking those active strides to now correct or fix the language that you may have, that may have been harmful to others. And this is what we kind of learn as human beings. We're very rooted in this collectivized species. Like, we desire kinship, we desire humanly and animal connections. And so a lot of us need that time to grow within ourselves and our community to have that opportunity to create change.
You get someone else's version of what history was or history is, and it's kind of a subjective view. And I think, you know, that saying question everything is actually not a bad thing to keep, you know, in your head.
Yeah. And I think it's the idea of like recognizing your experiences or people who experience injustices, whether it's workplace, academic, or internally in home, like, is not to say like, oh, your experience doesn't matter, but understanding when to apply your experience, what specific issues are coming up, and like how to level that pain. Because I think I see a lot of people silencing their pain and being like, oh, well, other people have it worse, therefore I should silence myself. And that kind of leads to this like toxic cycle to yourself, where you're not able to address your healing, what your purposes are for yourself. And so I always tell people, no one's perfect, and we're all messing up as beings. And that's what really makes us perfect in this world, is our imperfections.
This kind of brings us to climate doomism in a way. Yes. Because so explain to me, I just learned from you about climate doomism, and I am completely intrigued.
Yeah. So I would say that doomism is kind of in reference and tangential to doomsayer. I believe in folklore and a lot of mythical cultures, there's always a doomsayer that said like the end of the world or something will happen. And so doomism, climate doomism specifically, looks into describing that the destruction of the planet due to anthropogenic actions. And so the thing about climate doomism is that it's really centered on this idea of human supremacy being the main drive of cause. And I think that what is really important to recognize is that the framing of human supremacy that has been argued is essentially saying, like, you know, we must be more exact in the language of why we're in this ecological crisis, right? The idea that white supremacy itself is depleting natural resources at a fast rate. The idea that this colonial structures that we've had that exists within the industry now, that pollute and oppress other beings on this planet is the direct relationship of why we're in this ecological crisis. And so I think that with climate doomism, a lot of climate deniers and anti-environmentalists use this as a tactic to kind of disempower collectivized movements, meaning that, like, even though we're seeing a lot of reports coming out about it's going to continue getting worse, I think that a lot of these people are now using these tactics to really put down others and to say the work you do is meaningless no matter what you do because we're still going to be worse. And so this kind of ends up leading to unsustainable activism for a lot of people. Best way to create this change and to find solution is for a lot of people to recognize, like, what their role is in this movement and mm-hmm. to recognize and unlearn a lot of things. Because I think the idea of this world of, like, a lot of people wanting this glamorized, like, eco-friendly products and don't talk about race, just talk about, like, you know, diversity, but keep it very simple, is very limiting. And so I think that a lot of people feel uncomfortable the deeper you get into these conversations. And I will say that to myself too, and especially when it comes to Black and Indigenous liberation, like, why do I feel uncomfortable? Meaning that I have a lot of work to unpack there too. And a lot of people don't want to reckon with that because it makes them feel out of place. And so when you have a community and such as people hold you accountable, that pushes you to do, create everlasting change, because there'll be more support on the front lines, more donations being centered on Black and Indigenous organizations, more people recognizing, like, I want to be an educator, or I just want to be someone to help redistribute funds or money or food in some way whenever there's a disaster. And so I think that in order to kind of create solutions, we need to first, like, understand, like, why do we continue to silence ourselves or to choose to ignore these injustices? Is it because we're afraid to do this work, or we just generally just don't care? And I think a lot of people have a hard time understanding those interconnections.
I think a lot of it comes too with the fear of confrontation.
Yes.
You know, I've got a family member that didn't vote the way I do and doesn't think the way I do about a lot of social issues. And it's come to the point where we just can't talk about it. We cannot go there, and it gets really ugly. And I think I never thought I'd have a sibling in my family that I couldn't communicate with. To me, that's really sad. And I used to think, how can that happen? But now I get it. Like, I get it.
Yeah, and I think it's based off accountability, right? Meaning that, like, in a lot of my own sibling relationships, like, we get really heated debates and it gets bad, but never to the point where we're like, we're not gonna talk to you. More like, maybe we get mad at that action that we did and we reinstate it to be like, this is very hurtful what you said, I hope you reflect. And, you know, we kind of build on and educate ourselves. But I think it is a lot for people to kind of create those, like, cutting relationships is very traumatic. And I think that also that is a lot for people to risk, whether it's financially or their own sibling or loved one provided them, like, mental resources. Like, there's just so much to unpack. But I think that in taking it in smaller steps rather than just confronting the issue at first and then them shutting down, I think, like, but I think, yeah, it is really hard.
How many siblings do you have?
Yeah, I have two siblings. I have a brother that's 2 years older than me and a sister that's 4 years older than me. And my sister and I share the same birthday, but different year, which is pretty unique.
Oh, very cool. Do you share the same beliefs too?
Yeah, we're actually very close. It's very weird because we were born in the same time. It's just the year is, she was 92 and I was 96. So we often feel like we could have been twins if we had grown up, you know, living in the same year.
So she's sort of your ally and supports you, I'm assuming, in your endeavors. That's cool.
Yeah. And my brother too. I love him too. We're close too, but we have a different relationship sometimes.
Well, that's it. I mean, you know, these are relationships that grow over time. Mm-hmm. And it's not like you wake up one day and you both disagree. It's something where, you know, all these issues, I think, and that's the hardest part, is to be able to communicate with each other. All these issues kind of build up inside us, and we all start to take a stand over time, right? And then, and you might be kind of chipping away a little bit at part of the topic, but when you really delve into it, you realize just how divided you are. And that, to me, is the biggest challenge, because if we stay divided, nothing gets done. We've seen that in Washington. You know, if we do stay on opposite sides of the fence, there's no unifying solution. So I feel that one of the biggest challenges is to be able to get people who don't agree with the changes, you know, you and I might want to see, to get them to at least start considering them, even just to get them to think about it without getting really pissed off.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
We should talk about your website and talk about, you know, the name of your website. Your website name is Queer Brown Vegan. Tell me about how you came up with that. How did that come about?
Yeah, definitely. I would say that, you know, a huge part of my whole like work is rooted in environmental justice, meaning that like as a person of color, especially I'm Mexican myself, and growing up queer and trying to find myself out, like those are very two personal values that I hold because they mean so much to me, right? Like I believe that I fell in love with my queerness in college from the ages of 18 and 21 to finally develop myself in a more mature age post-grad. And I'd say that veganism came at the end of college after just realizing the human and animal rights abuses in industrial agriculture, and just was like, I just cannot support this system that exploits undocumented farm workers and kills a lot of animals and very horribly. And so I just didn't want to do that. And so I chose Queer Brown Vegan because I was at the airport one day at after a conference, and I was like, okay, I'm going to create an educational account. And my friend's like, what do you want to name it? And I was like, Queer Brown. And I was like, Vegan Brown Queer, or Brown Vegan Queer. And then I was like, what about QVV, like Queer Brown Vegan? So since then, I believe that I really pushed the emphasis about environmental justice, veganism, and kind of a zero waste, is the fact of like zero waste for me, the way I see it, is through circular systems, meaning that whatever we put into the earth goes back into the earth in a circular matter, organic matter. And so to me, zero waste wasn't specifically like, oh, I'm low waste, in the sense of like, I tell people straight up that I still use plastic in my kitchen because it's just impossible for me right now to live plastic free, or like I don't have the money to go to farmers markets every week. It's expensive.
And see, that's a really good point, because, you know, you walk into a Walmart or a Target even, and it's wall-to-wall plastic. You're right. It's unfair, because if you don't have an income or a decent income, it's very difficult to be able to afford something that's plastic free.
Yeah.
And even if you can afford it, so many people that can afford to like forego all their plastic just don't, because it's so inconvenient.
Yeah. And I think we just generate waste in a lot of ways because we've been indoctrinated. I think there's a active action that we can do to reduce plastic. Like I can definitely confirm, like, yes, I have reduced my plastic usage growing up, but at the same time, like, so many people get fixated on the lifestyle that end up forgetting about plastic pollution. It has created an environmental injustice, right? The people that actually live near these petrochemical companies are Black and Latinx individuals that all people who would give birth have reproductive issues now. And so a lot of us have to ask ourselves, like, are we going to continue spending that much energy destroying ourselves to try to be perfect? Or are we going to take that energy to actively reduce our plastic waste while also getting educated about how do we reduce plastic usage as a whole, as a system, or hold these corporations accountable for what they did to other mothers and people who give birth?
Well, and I feel like the only solution for plastic waste is to outlaw plastic use, to outlaw companies using plastic. You deal with these tough topics all the time. What is your trick for staying positive?
I always tell people, like, I believe that, like, to stay positive in some way is to validate your own lived experiences and to really unlearn self-doubt and more to be around people, not that just uplift you, but also kind of hold you accountable when you mess up, because I think that's the most important thing in my life now is like, I don't want to be someone that thinks I know everything at this age, when in reality, every year, I always tell myself, I want to learn more wisdom, I want to unlearn, I want to continue growing, because I don't want to be, you know, 30 or 40, like my parents were, and like, they were very fixated on cultural traditions and like their beliefs. And so it took years for them to unlearn that. So I'm like, I don't want to become like that either.
And then you mentioned your parents in the beginning. Are they still living where you grew up?
Yeah, so actually they moved recently with my sister. So they no longer live in the environment that we used to live in. But it was a good step for them to get away, because we kind of explained to them like living there is unsustainable, and you know, it's time for them to consider moving to places where it's more accessible for them as they've gotten older.
Mm-hmm. And how do they feel about your work?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that they don't fully understand what I do. They're happy like what I'm doing, I think, because there's often this language barrier, but my mom follows me on Instagram. And so she recognizes that I'm doing like environmental work and I'm doing public speaking. And so she's more like, oh, he's doing conservation work and, you know, diversity. But I think like she supports me as a whole. And she's like, I'm happy as long as you have money to pay your rent and healthcare. That's all that matters.
So I would bet they're very, very proud of you.
Yes, I think they are. I think it's such a weird way, because, you know, the careers that I thought I wanted growing up is way different from what they expected of me. And now they're just more like, you know, we're happy that we see you doing your thing that you wanted to do.
Where are you headed next on your amazing journey and your mission?
The projects that I will say that I've been working on is that I am in the process of finishing up a book proposal to my literary agent about veganism, zero waste, and environmental justice. So that is on its way, hopefully, as once I get approved for a book offer, and hopefully go more into video and digital series.
I love the fact that you're, you know, going to be doing a book. I know that will happen regardless of when. I do have faith that someone very smart will pick up your book and publish you for sure. What about politics, Isaias? Do you think that that is the best or one of the ways to and make real change? Or do you feel it's best to go about it kind of from the grassroots level and create a movement?
Yeah, I would say that they both can coexist, because a lot of grassroots movements recognize that if there is going to be some reform, the end goal should be to abolish that existing system or policy that is preventing. But, you know, being able to do reforms or to create legislations and groups for that is super essential. And I think that with storytelling, this is what activates people to get involved in their own community, like specifically me with environmental justice, because a lot of city governments would have a lot of meetings in my area to represent the valley. But I recognize that hardly any of the flyers that were being put out there were in Spanish or in different languages. So fighting for language accessibility to me was really helpful. Although I would say that it's, you know, it's not going to fix everything in one day, but it does provide action and empowers people to be like, oh, I have something to say about this. So I think that's what really kind of gives me hope to see in these different movements that people are, you know, examining policies and asking themselves, like, who do they benefit and for whom? But also telling ourselves, like, you know, as we exist in these spaces and we have to exist in these political systems, that's not to say that we shouldn't strive away from them and not do anything, because in reality, a lot of us want change in our community. However, what resource or what communities want to use me as a resource, I'm always more than willing to extend myself on that and not to be a leader, but more of a what you would call the bridge between those entering the movement and then those who are taking rest from being in the movement. So that's what really makes me happy to see that there's different roles in everyone's life.
The work you're doing now is just really inspiring.
That means so much to me. And I just appreciate your kind words. It means a lot to just continue reminding myself not to give in self-doubt and just to empower others around me too, to ensure that their narratives are heard too. So thank you so much.
Thank you so very much for taking the time to speak with me, Isaias.
Yes, thank you so much, Jermaine, for having me, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
We hope this podcast has made you more conscious about how you're impacting the planet and that you'll visit our website, majamas.com. There you'll find our sustainable collections and links to our blog, wearemajamaseearth.com, where you can learn even more about our guests and our passion for the planet. Help us out. Follow us on Instagram and Pinterest at majamas_earth and on Facebook at majamaseearth. Care what you wear, and remember, collectively, we have the power to save the planet.